Hello, and thank you for listening to the new series, Series 2 of the Nurse Researcher Podcast. This series aims to chat to clinical academics and to really identify what their role entails, how the jobs are split, what they do in their daily life, and really what are the tips and what advice can they give to people aspiring to be a clinical academic. So give us a listen, share the podcast with others, press follow wherever you listen to or get your podcasts, and we hope you enjoy the episodes. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Nurse Researcher Podcast, our second series, our clinical academic series, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Oladayo Beforin. And Oladayo is a senior lecturer from Liverpool John Moores University. Oladayo, it's fabulous to have you with us.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm happy to be here.
And in this series, we're really keen to hear really how the clinical academic role works for people, because I don't think there's one clear definition of what that role is. So this is all about you. It's your story. And I force everybody to go back in time a little bit and tell us, why did you become a nurse?
That's a good question. I grew up surrounded by nurses. My mom recently retired as a director of nursing service in one of the most prominent teaching hospitals in Nigeria. I've got three aunties, if not more, who are nurses. My late grandmother, who actually was very, very important to me. She actually owned a maternity center when I was growing up. She was involved in cohort studies published with medical practitioners who visited my village at the time, talking perhaps in the 50s, if you like. And it was is interesting that with all of that, nursing did not occur to me to be something I can do, because listening to my mom, for example, she comes back from home and it's very much draining and it's very, very sometimes quite political and all of that. And I'm thinking, no, that's not for me. But interestingly, she would say what was in the passing, to say, Oladaya, you will make a good nurse. And again, I didn't think of that. It wasn't something I actually ruminated on at all, until I moved to England. The first job I had was in Bath, and of course, to survive, to make a living for myself, I started working as a nursing assistant in this particular nursing home. And this very day, it was a community mental health nurse who worked to assess a particular patient. And what she did was use Beck's anxiety tool to assess the patient. And that was the light bulb moment for me, thinking, hang on, so nursing can be objective. And that was how it started. And a part of me as well is, again, listening to one of your professor's series, Professor Parveen Ali, who actually made an argument around this anti-intellectualism in nursing. Perhaps that was the subconscious that was there for me, and again, it was very much about that particular community nurse. The impact is what has brought me this far.
Yeah, and I remember Parveen's episode very well. I remember talking about her family's perception of nursing and her village's perception of nursing. Slightly different for her culturally than you and I. She's female. I think one of the issues for me starting out was that friends, family were a bit like, nurse, you're a man. How was that for you in Nigeria? How have you found that in the UK? Does that impact on you being male and being a nurse?
Yes, absolutely. So for me, that would be one of the reasons. I mean, I saw my mom work with nurses who are men. And again, I wasn't actively thinking of that. But coming to the UK, I think the impact of that was what led me into them being a mental health nurse, because it's not particularly nursing, if you like. So a part of me was thinking, but fundamentally, what led to me going for mental health nursing was particularly about the idea of nursing and the idea of nursing the mind That was intriguing for me. How can you be objective as a nurse? And how do you then bring objectivity in nursing the mind? Again, that was a key component of me then heading towards mental health. And again, on a personal level, is looking around me when I attend church, or I go to communities event when I was in Bristol, is looking at how people perhaps in the environment were behaving. In Nigeria, we wouldn't use the word mental health where I grew up. I'm not generalizing here. We wouldn't use the word depression. We wouldn't use the word anxiety. But when I started working in nursing home, and I'm looking at what these things are, what's the characteristics of having depression, what that looked like, I started to think back to when I was growing up in Nigeria, how this person would just snap, how this person would just would talk out of context. But again, you can't talk that person down because they are older than you are. So that led me into mental health nursing. And to add to that is I saw family members go through the impact of discrimination and structural racism in terms of access and services. So all of that put together, I wasn't particularly thinking of being a nurse anymore. It was then becoming something I had to do something about in my own little way. And to make a start is actually, let me go and obscure myself and see what I can do.
Yeah, so that was your, they're really your drivers for engagement with academia, aren't they? So where did that take you? Were you thinking straight from being a nurse that I want to do a PhD, or did you do a master's route? And what was the sort of question, what was the inquiry that you'd got that took you to that, let's say, the PhD?
So for me, I had a first degree in Nigeria in industrial chemistry. So coming to the country, I wanted to do a master's in forensic chemistry at the University of Bradford. But whilst trying to make sense of saving some money and all of that, started working in nursing home. So again, what I was honest with myself, thinking I studied in Nigeria, this is a new terrain. I don't want to just rush into. And I think that was one the advice from my wife actually at the time, my wife. Because it was very much about let's explore you going back to college. Now, finishing PhD, sorry, finishing your first degree in Nigeria, coming to a new country, then going back to college, that was a very difficult moment for me, I must be honest. But it was what I had to do at the time, and it's one of the things I'm very grateful for. Return back to college, did access to health and social care, and was working in an agency, working in a nursing home, and then from that went to Edge University. I got to Edge University. The intention was to do a BSc program. My very first assignment had 90, 97% or something like that. I had high grades. And again, it was very timely that was a time there was now the push for accelerated masters. So I had good grades in the very first year of the BSc. And all of a sudden, someone approached and said, "You've got good grades. This is an accelerated masters. You've got a degree already. Is that an option for you? Why not?" I jumped on that. So for me, and then finished my program. But again, before finishing my program, don't forget that I've always been in the healthcare environment as a nursing assistant for me, my experience in at the university, I keep seeing the practice theory divide. And it's just keeps screaming at me because you go to you this theoretical environment, they sell this big dream. This is what it should look like, the actual. But in terms of the reality, it's very different. And that is how, again, I started to think of myself in terms of my identity as a mental health nurse. Qualified, started working in the forensic setting. And again, I enjoyed that. Again, you see some side comments about why using a tool to engage in one-to-one nursing session. Again, I think about it thinking, that's how I practice. I want to be able to measure what is working, what's not working. Or I write something and someone says, just write a little bit, don't write it too much. And I start getting those sort of niggling comments, and I'm thinking, but fantastically, this is a big shout out to the likes of Diane Rice, who was my preceptor at the time, who then turned and said, let him write the way he can write. And those things gave me the confidence that someone here can see something different that I can add. And again, going back to LG University, My first assignment was marked by Dr. David Stonehouse. Again, shout out to him. His feedback was amazing. It was just something that, and I approached him and I said, I want to publish my piece of work. And he sent me some pointers. And from there, I started publishing all my assignments because I couldn't bear having to submit an assignment on a virtual learning environment and do nothing with it. And I started publishing them, and I started publishing them. One of the papers I published with David Stoner, so I think now we've got five papers together, these articles, so not particularly empirical piece of work. One of them actually was referenced in a policy in Australia. I noticed that last week. And again, that's going back to the clinical environment. I started thinking about what do I do with this, and it was clear to me as day that I need to be able to articulate clinical problems better. And against that backdrop, again, I'm going to take us back a little bit as well in terms of before I left LG University, I've been reaching out to people that how do I do a PhD? I've been asking those questions. But at the time, LG, they had a good culture. So again, one of your speakers, Professor Lucy Bray, health literacy, child health literacy, she was in that space. You had, I think, Dr. Professor Jeremy Brown, he was into medical education. I approached those people, but because their area of interest wasn't really what I wanted to do, I moved on. But I must say that I sent out about 10 emails to random professors in the UK, saying I want to do a PhD. And it's interesting that about 2 years after, only one of them replied to me, Professor Jan Oyebode in Bradford, who then said a scholarship is available for a particular project. This is going to go out this time, apply for it. And the project was around issues relating to caring for other people in mainland China. But my project itself then ended up being, my title was very much something along the lines of intersections between culture, social demographic change and caring. Which had to do with caregivers of older people in mainland China. And that qualitative piece of work was what I did whilst being within my clinical environment. I just had to reduce my hours drastically whilst carrying on with my day job and spending the vast majority of my time doing my PhD.
No wonder. I mean, you've addressed some of the things I was going to ask. So that transition from the accelerated master's to the PhD is quite swift, but essentially what you demonstrated through your publications is that you're more than capable because you've been almost stamping your mark on the things that you've studied, which is always valuable. You're setting quite a high bar here for future people on these interviews. They'll be thinking, oh my God, look at what he did at that level. So with the PhD, the role before you had the PhD, I suspect, wasn't a clinical academic role. Did your clinical academic role come postdoc? And how did that happen? Who decided it? What made you think that was the right thing to do to keep one foot in practice and one foot in academia? Now, how's it come about? How's it transpired contractually and between who?
Whilst I've always stayed in clinical practice, so when I finished my PhD, it was then a case of what next? But thankfully, a role came up for part-time, which had to do with quality improvement. So I thought that's I can work in that space where you use the PDSM methodology to support and help nursing staff. So that's how I spinned research into what I was doing at the time. So I did that for a while. And then it was again timely that the Office of Life Science and NIHR then funded a demonstration site called MREC, Mental Health Research for Innovation Centre in Liverpool. And that was how the role for the research and effectiveness lead came up in my trust. I went for that as well. But after my PhD, the natural transition was to go become a lecturer. I applied for a post with Liverpool John Mosse University. So I had the bulk of my time spent there. But in terms of my clinical work, that was a part-time role. So it again is two different contracts up to date. And recently I also secured a place within the NIHR Senior Research Leadership Program, which is giving me more time to try and help us in my organization sort of embed the research culture, which I've always been an advocate for, right from the point that I qualified, that for us to break the gap between, the ideal and the actual. What happens in theoretical landscape and what happens in practical in the practical sense, for us to bridge that research is that sort of gives us the opportunity. I've always been banging on that, and I think doing a PhD has allowed me to better articulate that, and of course to reach out to people. As I've mentioned before, I'm the type that would send out cold emails to people that I don't know. I will articulate the problem. I'm comfortable I'm very comfortable with being uncomfortable, is what I'm getting at. That all I can get is a no.
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing to lose, is there, in those circumstances?
No.
So you've got this role. It's considered a clinical academic role. Who agrees with who? Do is it a situ And this is really for the listener thinking, well, how do you formulate these roles? So is this a role where you're taken clinically for X number of days a week and Liverpool John Moore are reimbursed? Or was it one role together, advertised that you'd work across two areas, or is it two jobs within 1 week?
As you've rightly alluded to at the start of this podcast, that we don't have a clear pathway. For me, two different jobs, but I make it make sense. So I get a clinical problem. I tend to supervise students at who comes for a master's program. If we need to do a service evaluation, we'll support that through that space. So it's me making those connections. Research and effectiveness lead is basically my role is how do we increase research capacity and capability of our sort of underrepresented workforce, and that's my particular focus at this point in time. And it starts with your doing clinical audits, whatever support I can give to you in that sense. It's doing your service evaluation, whatever support I can give to anyone in that sense. But I must say that in the context of mental health, we still have we have a long way to go in terms of embedding research into our clinical environment.
Yeah, of course you do. And it's good to really see. We didn't have it in the professor series at all, but the different fields of nursing being represented as clinical academics, because we can learn a great deal from one another, can't we, across the disciplines and across the fields particularly. But with you, what is your working week? Is it a 50-50 split? Do you feel like one role really bleeds into the other, or do they feel like there's a clear line of demarcation between the two?
There's no particular clear line of demarcation. But as I mentioned before, this is the beauty that I see in clinical academic pathway where you can be innovative. So at my university, I would teach, I would see my personal students. Again, conversations in that space is making sure they're aware of what is possible research, apart from the checking in that they are well in terms of their well-being. But for me is also trying to make sure that they get the right support. The questions they're asking really aligns with the clinical problems we have now. In terms of how I currently work a lot with our nurses and allied professionals, so I reach out to them. I meet them regularly. I know what is happening within the clinical settings, and so my role is to listen to that. And I'll give two examples here. For example, one of a particular site are working around. They have got a self care pathway. And what do? I get clinicians in that space to join my teaching when I'm teaching, and I embed their teaching. I put a lot of empirical studies to support what they're doing. They've got that already. They enjoy that. Against that teaching, that's led us to submitting a paper for publication for that. Another one is getting a master's student from who's a mental health nurse, but from a different trust, who wants to do some work around minoritized ethnic communities who are Muslims. That's my own area of interest is very much about examining the mental health care pathways, with a particular focus on reducing health inequalities. So when it came around, it was a case of I want to do this empirical study, fantastic, but let's go and do a consultation first. Went into the community, and again, that particular paper was going to be published hopefully anytime in the summer. And we're going to present that also as well at the RCN International Conference, because that was accepted yesterday. And that is the joy in it. So going back to your question, it's difficult to say there's a clear demarcation. It's difficult to say it's a 40-60, 50-50. But what I do is making sure that I prioritize what is really important and make it make sense for that journey I am on.
And do you keep both paymasters happy? I do you get problems from the university saying, well, we need a bit more from you, or from the clinician saying we need a bit more of you? Because you'll have sort of two bosses or line managers because you've got two different areas. Does that make life difficult? Are you playing one against the other a little bit?
If I'm honest, I think that's where I would say I'm particularly blessed, if you like, that as long as I no one is monitoring me, as long as I am committed to teaching, I plan my teaching, I have a good work ethics, I show up, I take off my responsibility, I've not had any problems. And if I am struggling with something, I know I can quickly drop a line to my line managers. And both of them also, they are in contact with one another, so they have each other's contacts. So if that's not happened before, but the line of communication is open, is what I'm saying here, and it's on me to ensure that I maintain that. But having said that, I think the future is having it would be good to have clinical academics that actually are coming from our NHS organizations. If you ask me, that'd be my own take on this. Where you are seconded to universities, I think that would be particularly a sort of a pragmatic approach. Particularly if you think about the chief nursing officer's research strategy and the sort of documents that come through about SOTS, understanding trust readiness to do research. You think about the concept of knowledge mobilization. The NHS has a role to play in that, and I look forward to the future where we can have associate professors who are actually NHS grown. I think that would be how I see this going forward.
And there's a from a knowledge mobilization perspective, there's a term that I've heard a few times over the last few years is boundary spanning roles. And it's people like you that can speak the language of both settings. So you can speak to your academics confidently and you can speak to your clinical colleagues confidently. And I think, nurses are ideal for that, aren't they? Being able to boundary span and do these sorts of things. And you have that ability. Are there any issues? Is there things that you would change? How would you improve the way? And I know I'm not trying to put you on the spot here to criticize anybody or anything in particular, but what do you find difficult having to split your time?
I think it's been particularly difficult for me because I wouldn't say we have many mental health nurses who are readers or professors. I can think of two professors who are mental health in my head at the moment, two, three. And it's very challenging. If you are in a sort of a cancer space, you've got a professor who can lead on a big grant and you have a small work package you can lead, but I'm having to create stuff from the scratch. I'm having to do some sort of mentoring and leadership at the very stage. But the good thing for me is that I've come from a collectivist society where you tend to take responsibility at a very early age. Early age, and that I think has played to my advantage in this context. The challenge has always been because people's perception of you can then be, oh, you're doing quite a lot of things. No, I don't have the capacity in terms of research capacity for me to do my research, that the appetite has to be right. And that's where I'm devoting my time at the moment, with the view that with the new drive for research, and particularly within the nursing workforce, that we would have more people who are going to qualify and they get their first job in the research post. People who are going to qualify and they are comfortable to say, you know what, I want to be a clinical academic, and they get the right support. People who are going to say, you know what, I just want to be a researcher and I'm a nurse, because that diversity is what we need in terms of being able to put us in a position to better articulate the challenges we face currently in terms of mental health service provision, because the WHO is clear that our services, broadly speaking, are obsolete. Obsolete.
And I think we mustn't question people's need, or we mustn't try and focus on people's needs to be fully clinical to move into academia. You wouldn't want, if I see somebody who's a real shining light academically, if they're a third year student nurse and I think they could do a PhD, to me, the sooner I can get them doing that PhD, the better. I don't see why I've got to send them out somewhere first for them to do that, because they can have an academic role in nursing, in a different way. And you've also got that element of, to some extent, that this fear, haven't you, that you've got to do 5 years here, or you've got to do 10 years here. And we discussed this, didn't we, before this interview? We had a little chat about the interview. I think, if somebody comes to me and said, I've done 3 years training and gerontology is the place for me, I go, great, you can find a job. If they say vascular is the place for me, I'd go, great, that's the place to go. If they go, research is the place for me, I'd go, great, that's what you want to do then. Why would I hinder them or stop them trying to go down that route? So I think it's important that we recognize if people have what you've got, clearly, very intelligent, naturally academic, done the master's very quickly, arrived with a bachelor's degree, why would we not be sort of pushing the fact that you could take this further? So it's really good, isn't it, that somebody spotted that in you and recognized that you could do that. And we need to have a number of people, don't we? We need to have nurses out there, or we need to have particularly academics out there recognizing people that we don't need to send into something that they perhaps don't want to do to then come back. That if they can do it there and then, do it there and then.
Absolutely. And one of the work that comes to mind, I can't recall the author's name. She did a work and it was very much about talent management. And the outcome there was very much about that sort of the social benefits. And that itself has a potential in terms of nursing retention. Because if we were to keep talking, we want to put people into one box. That is where the problem is. That's the first step for starters. The other point I want to get at there is that the more diverse we are in that space, the better for us, because we would see things differently. And the more we see things differently, the better for us to produce evidence-based in terms of providing personal care, providing care that is precise, providing care that is proven. And that is the ultimate goal, evidence-based mental health nursing practice, as far as I'm concerned. And we've got to identify talent right from the outset and offer them opportunities to get them to keep them going, because you can't go from having nothing to applying for NIHR doctoral fellowship. What happens in between? And that is where your clinical academic can play a fantastic role in nurturing, in shaping, in mentoring, in supporting. Leadership comes natural to that space, as far as I'm concerned. And not everyone would want to go the academic pathway, but the ones that want to go, let's not make them feel as if they are so ambitious, or they want to fly before they can walk. I've had that term said to me on an occasion, and the person who said it, I didn't think he was it wasn't malicious. I know that, because she's a caring person. But when you say that to someone who is trying to make sense of these things, the impact of that can be damning.
It stifles and it slows you
Indeed.
down, to do that.
Indeed.
So I'm conscious to get back to you because we're talking about what you can do with others, but we'll sort of get around that now with my next question. So firstly, congratulations on the senior research leader title. It
Thank you.
clearly is well deserved. So what's the future hold for you with that title and without? What is your focus? What's the next move for you?
Next move for me, I think, is I'm at the right place at this point in time where we can have these conversations. And I'm really looking forward to joining the likes of yourself, of course. Congratulations to you, for the senior research leadership position, is bouncing off ideas of each other. What do you do in your space that I can add to what I do here? What am I currently doing that potentially someone can see and say, oh, hang on, that's fantastic, but it's not occurred to me that it's fantastic. Having that sort of a supportive ecosystem for the next 3 years, and hopefully that would shape my personal direction, because I think I don't shy away from saying that the next step for me would be leadership, and working towards that, and again is finding people that you can collaborate with, who will strengthen what you do, and people that you can also work with and strengthen what they do. So that's the path for me. I'm lucky to have fantastic people who support me. Largely speaking, a lot of them not particularly from nursing. If I'm honest, I've got nursing colleagues who are great, but in terms of the researchy component, in terms of people that gets me, it's not from nursing. It's and which is not a problem. But I think I'm looking forward to meeting other nurses as well, the new ones coming through that would want to actually take that risk, because for me it was a risk that I took.
And you and what you've spotted there is that you're trailblazing to some extent because you're having to go beyond your field to find research expertise. So a real, to me, listening in, I think a real success of you would be for the next generation of nurses to have you, wouldn't it? Somebody that they can come to in their field to support and research, whereas you've had to look out of the field a little bit. And I think for me, as when I started my PhD, it's 15 years ago now, but I had to go to a medical school, and my supervisors weren't nurses. And I think we've moved on so much in those 15 years. And I think the important thing is, like you say, learning from one another. I think inclusivity with nursing. I'm very keen that we don't sort of work against and opposed to one another. We work with one another. I think nursing, if it wants to start climbing the ladder quickly with research, we've got to collaborate. We've got to be collegiate. And we've got to sort of share expertise and make the bid stronger by having the broader, wider teams. So I'm really looking. I mean, you've dropped it now, but yes, I got the senior research leader title as well. I'd kept that one to myself. But I'm looking forward to working with you. I think we think the same. And I think there'll be opportunities to work together as part of that role. So it's wonderful to hear that we are like-minded with those sorts of things. So one little question which you might feel is in early in your career to say it, but would you do anything differently from the start of your research career to now?
Would I do anything differently? It's difficult to say because there's no pathway. So I can't, it's difficult to compare to something. But in terms of doing things differently, I think it's making sure, which I don't know if I will be, I don't know if I can even do that, making sure that people can see what you see. Because sometimes I make assumptions that people understand that, for example, we don't have research capacity within mental health space, for example. And so when I'm talking about I need to do things differently, they are with me, but I make those assumptions. And oftentimes I might have lost some people along the journey. I think it's making it clear where the problem really is, or the scale of the problem. And then leaning towards this is how you can potentially support me. That is something I could have done differently. Perhaps get more nurses who are leaders to work with me. But the good thing is that at this point in time, I'm getting the attention based on of course on merits, what I do, of senior people who sees the value that I can add. So in hindsight, that is what I would do differently. But again, seeing the outcome that I currently have, I could equally say, I don't think I would do anything differently.
Well, that's good to hear because it feels like the path you've trodden is the path that you wished to tread. So I'll flip the question finally, and this will be my final question to you. What would be your tips and advice for people thinking, I want a clinical academic role? What do I need to do now?
To want a clinical academic role, I think one thing I've said consistently here is you've got to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. I struggled to get the words out before, and that's just the essence that there's no clear pathway, and I hope things change as we move along. But if you're going to be a clinical academic, there's nothing set in stone. It is what you make of it, and more importantly, go where you're needed. Go where you're needed will be my own sort of my point, because some people, no matter how much you talk about it, they might not see what you see. It's important not to feel comfortable to say, I just want to be here. If you're not valued, if you feel that they don't get what you want to do, send out cold emails to people. And largely speaking, when I get reply, everyone is nice. So it's not, the perception could be, what would they think of me? They can think what they want to think of you. But if you get what you want to get out of it for your own self, then that's a win. That's a win is what I would say. So it's putting yourself out there. The networking skills is so important. You've got to network, 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 network. And sometimes things might go wrong, and having that emotional intelligence to be quick to take up your responsibility, and having sort of harder to harder conversations. I think that's what I would say.
Wonderful. Well, great advice. Oladayo, you are clearly a role model, I think, to mental health nurses. And I think it sounds to me like you're going to go far. It will be a delight to meet you soon and to be able to work with you. And we thank you for your time on the podcast.
Thank
Oladayo,
you
thanks
very
very
much.
much. Hello and welcome back to the Nurse Researcher podcast. And joining me again for our summary is Eleanor Hovard. And today we're talking about Oladayo and his episode and his interview, Eleanor. We were both fascinated and both really impressed with what he had to say and his role, weren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, wow, what an inspirational story. I think so many great and interesting points that Oladayo raised. But for me, I think the crux of it is that he said he took responsibility for carving his own bespoke clinical academic career, really. And he credits that to his upbringing, being taught to take collective responsibility from a young age. And I think I'd agree if you decide to. You want to develop an academic or clinical academic career in nursing, you've got to take a lot of responsibility for it yourself. But as Oladayo also said, you need to surround yourself with the right support. Sometimes that can be really hard, though, can't it, to figure out who those people are and find them? You know, he said it took 2 years before somebody responded to his request for his idea about his PhD. And again, that's a bold step I think you have to take, isn't it, when you are thinking about your ideas. Who do you talk to? Who do you approach? And sometimes it's the first rejection as well, isn't it, that you face on that pathway because people don't always respond. And you have to have an idea that another expert's interested in and has the time to supervise you on. I think that's quite a hard step to navigate. And it can be really off-putting. But I think what Oladayo also demonstrated here is that persistence, and you have to have it. It's a, you know, you have to have that desire, don't you, to go down this path. And there's a great deal of uncertainty that comes with it. And as he says, you know, you've got to put yourself out there in so many ways. And I think, you know, that stays with you, something you constantly have to do. And he's so right. He says you have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable as well, because there are risks, aren't there, when you're taking a clinical academic route still in this landscape, because you're working very often with two organizations, maybe more. You're trying to align your clinical work and your academic work. You're not exactly sure how it's going to work out. Sometimes you have to put your clinical career on pause to build up the academic side, and then vice versa. And I think, you know, Oladayo also raised an important point that many nurses don't know they can do this. They don't know how, they don't know that they can email people about their ideas, maybe even frightened to do that. And this is where I think we've got to get better with talent spotting, which he also mentioned.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he impressed me no end, really, the wisdom that he offers and the guidance whilst he's still on that pathway himself, really. And you'll be pleased to hear that his favorite part of our podcast is the summary section. So
Oh.
that must be linked to you, Eleanor, because I don't talk so much
Don't know about that.
in the episode. So he was sort of, I'm laughing now thinking, because he'll listen to this like everybody else does, but he was conscious of what we'd say about him. But I can, rightfully, I can only be positive. I thought the story was fascinating. I think the mum as a nurse is something that we've heard often from people, because that often inspires you. But when he talked about his mum doing cohort studies, it sounds like his mum was a clinical academic, a long time ago, and in his home
Absolutely.
country of Nigeria. So he had a role model from an early age, I would say. And I think he's clearly naturally academic, and the ability to do what he's done in a second language in a new country, I think, stands him in great stead for being a role model, for people that are trying to do the same thing. And equally, I think he's a role model for people who are mental health nurses, and he's a role model to some extent for male nurses. I think he carries all of that. I hope that's not a weight to carry, but I think he carries all of that. He's at the peak of his career. He's doing what he wants to do, and he's still developing. And I think what I try to say to him is that maybe the people that he couldn't find, he becomes for others. And he's a real role model for people.
He did say that, didn't he? And I love the advice Oladayo gave. What you make of it's what you make of it, isn't it? Go where you're needed. I think that's a really important point that he made there. Where you go, where your work is valued, you're putting yourself out there, which is a bit uncomfortable, but I think that does build confidence. I think we've probably all been through that, as we're on the route to clinical academic or academic careers. That very often you are putting yourself out there and not, maybe don't have the confidence. I certainly have felt that, but I think the more you do put yourself out there and put yourself in those spaces, it does help to build confidence, doesn't it? Because you don't know what you're capable of unless you try. And also, I think you mentioned about boundary spanning, or you mentioned it, and connecting with people outside of your usual networks as well. That really helps too, doesn't it? But I think, what he said about taking responsibility, be willing to take risks, but go where you're valued. And then that aiming to feel comfortable with being uncomfortable is just such valuable advice when you're on this pathway.
Yeah, and I think part of that is, if you've moved to a new country to take on an academic career, then moving around that country is doesn't mean a great deal to you. You're happy to travel, you're happy to go where you're needed. I think a lot of the time with probably nurses born in England or born in the UK is we probably stay local to where we were born, don't we? We do that, and we don't move universities, and we don't go often where our work's most valued. So he's been very brave in just thinking, well, I'm going to go where I'm going to achieve and I'm going to succeed. And I think that's, I often get criticized for staying in one area, staying at one university, but it worked for me because the best place to be for my research interest were that university. I think a lot of people probably get stuck in one area when actually you should take your expertise and your value to where it's most needed. And he's very brave in order to, be able to do those sorts of things and just think, right, and he found what sounded like a real supportive network at Edge Hill University, and he's continued to sort of go where he's needed to go to make sure that he can progress.
And it's also finding, when you've got an idea about something, it's finding other people out there who are interested in that area as well. But it does boil down to talent spotting too, I think, as well, doesn't it? When people see that somebody's got a real desire, but they've also got that potential as well. That needs nurturing. And it also, I think it sometimes creates a bit of buffering, but that support is really important. It absolutely sometimes I think takes a real village, but it's still that drive has to come from that person, that's on that pathway. I mean, people can give you support and guidance, but you have to actually do it. And there is a lot of taking risks sometimes as well, I think, isn't there?
I think he's a great advocate as well for the accelerated master's programs that you have at a lot of universities. People that have demonstrated the academic ability, they've got their first degree, and they are looking to almost do a shorter route to nursing, knowing that that's what they want to do and push on with. He did that master's route. I clearly did very well there. And you know what was it, 97% in his first assignment
Yeah,
on
it's
that.
amazing.
I don't think I've ever scored anybody that, certainly not at level 7. But so he was clearly flying from the off, and he's really been able to negotiate and navigate the clinical academic trade-off, both as a student and beyond that, hasn't he, right up to his PhD and beyond.
Yeah, and now wanting to support other nurses as well that are trying to do similar things. He mentioned, didn't he, about bridging that gap, about reaching out to people. You don't know, and learning about these programs that are on offer, and I guess many nurses don't know that they can do that. So he's also taking responsibility, isn't he, by being a senior research leader now to also do that. So there's so many facets, aren't there, I think, to being a clinical academic as well. But once you get to those certain, I suppose different levels, then you have more opportunities, hopefully, to be able to do different things like support other people too that need encouragement.
And even with the things that probably aren't straightforward in his role, he still remains positive about it. So, with all people on this series, I shall be asking about the pros and cons to the clinical academic role, but where there are difficulties, where he would say things like, "Well, there's no recognized pathway," I think he's carving his own. And that when I talked about the different sort of paymasters, that you're going to have your clinical line manager and you're going to have your academic line manager, he seems to have found a relationship with them where they're very supportive of him, and there's a trusting element. There's an autonomy that he's allowed, isn't he, to make both roles fit into one another and to benefit each other. And maybe searching for the perfect pathway or trying to divine the perfect pathway is impossible. It's the treasure at the end of the rainbow. I think maybe each pathway will always have to be different for the clinical academic.
I think so. I think it's very bespoke, isn't it? And there's decisions that have to be made. It's quite strategic at times, I think, as well, isn't it? But Aladai also mentioned it's quite creative, so you have to be creative, don't you, with your pathway as well. So like you said, I think he has approached it in a very positive way, thinking of the challenges maybe as more as opportunities, and what can I do and what do I need to do to be able to achieve this, and finding out, if you don't know, then sometimes you have to try and find people that can give you a bit of guidance, but you also have to use your own head, don't you, to make those decisions as to whether or not you want to take that risk, if that's where you want to go.
And I think he was very quick in thinking that on the new NIHR Senior Research Leadership Program, that he wants to work with other people to see what they do well and what advice and guidance people can share with one another to benefit from each other's experience. So I think there's a sense of that, if that's what that leadership program does, then that's a value to all people on it, isn't it? And I will
So.
look on that program for others that might be of value to the podcast as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's really important, and it's actually quite a rewarding aspect, I think, as well, isn't it, of being a clinical academic when you have had those experiences and you can share those with other people, offering that leadership advice to them.
And I think he's probably the only person that I've interviewed in series one or two that I haven't met in person, and I'm delighted to say I will be meeting him soon.
Oh, that's
So it will
exciting.
be nice to get to chat to him personally as well, because
Yeah.
it was one of those interviews where you thought it could be a two-parter. I could really open up a lot of this, but it's all about more listening to our guest, isn't it, on this podcast. I didn't want to carve open too much of his answers because I could have gone much deeper into how and what he did. But we want our podcast to be not so much bite-sized, but something that people can listen to in a sensible time span. But the more and more we do this, the more I think I could make, these interviews could last over an hour. And so it's important that we just get the right questions in. And if people listening to the podcast want to leave a comment, or if there's anything that they want us to ask the clinical academics, please do so, because we have spoken to nurses about what they'd want to ask about or to ask to clinical academics. And I think it's always crucial, if you think we've missed something, or if there's something that you need demystifying, a term that we've used, then do put a comment, and we can see if we can slot those into future episodes, because we want listeners to get value out of this, particularly those aspiring to be clinical academics, or those that want to learn from others.
Absolutely. Anala Dayo's interview is so valuable. So many words of wisdom in there for other clinical academics or nurses that aren't clinical academics yet. They're wondering how it all works.
Yeah. And well, I'll attach some of his papers in the episode notes. And equally, he's also given me his X hashtag. I've got to say that right. I don't want to say Twitter anymore. The artist formerly known as Twitter. I'll put his hashtag for X as well. And then if people want to follow him or look at the work that he's doing or indeed contact him, I'm sure he wouldn't mind you doing so. He's very engaging and somebody I think that we can all learn from.
Absolutely.
And that's probably us for this episode. I hope he likes the feedback. We've been extremely positive.
So, yeah, no, it's been fantastic.
It's the first person to ever say I like the summary or I listen most to the summary. So,
but
we're always positive, aren't we? We're always positive. We're not here to sort of pull people apart. We're there to get the gems and the nuggets from them, aren't we? Aren't we? That's what we're looking to do.
Absolutely. It's about sharing those inspirational leaders, isn't it? And role models.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Eleanor, for your time.
Thanks, Andrew.
Until the next one. See you soon.
Bye-bye.